Welcome to On the Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with finance, business, and the economy. On the Money is broadcast live from the studios of Radio 2 SER nationwide on the Community Radio Network. I'm Roderick Chambers, and coming up on the program today,
we just need to be asking the question of Coles and Aldi to please stop discounting milk at $1 a litre and ask those stores to move forward.
Woolworths' initiative to increase milk prices and pass it on to distressed and struggling dairy farmers has met with the approval of Minister David Littleproud and other industry commentators. But retailers Coles and Aldi seem unlikely to get on board. Also coming up on the show,
the limit on government spending in Australia is set by inflation, not by a lack of money.
That's a new idea. Economic thought is taking a new road, and it's called modern monetary theory. In this three-part series, Vincent Su investigates the potential for a new economics to cure unresponsive Western economies with Professor Stephen Hale from the University of Adelaide. All this and more coming up on The Money. But first, with the end of the Royal Commission into banking still in our rearview mirror, Westpac has become the first bank to be hit with a class action lawsuit. Law firm Maurice Blackburn will be arguing on behalf of disgruntled customers, and it comes after Westpac negotiated a $35 million settlement with corporate regulator ASIC over misconduct, only for that fine to be rejected by the federal court. So what's different this time, and what is the basis for this class action? Ben Robertson spoke to Cameron Murray, senior economist at the Australia Institute, to find out.
Essentially, banks, when they lend money, have an obligation to assess creditworthiness of a borrower. So it's not a one-sided transaction where it's borrower or buyer beware and the seller of the loan has no responsibility. And my understanding is that they are accusing the bank of not fulfilling that obligation and assessing the buyer's creditworthiness and their actual expenses. So that's, as far as I understand, the basis of the claim and the particulars of how the bank didn't fulfill their obligations for assessing creditworthiness is they used this household expenditure measure, which is this poverty line measure of household expenses for a typical family. And what banks, not just Westpac, but others have been doing is relying on this poverty measure of household spending and saying, hey, if this household has money left over above being at the poverty level, then they must be creditworthy and this loan must be suitable for them because they have the ability to repay. But if you think about that, what it really means is the person only has the ability to repay if they have poverty levels of expenditure. What they're saying is that there's this National Consumer Credit Protection Act, which requires banks to assess the actual expenses of applicants for loans. And by not actually assessing each individual for the basis of each loan, you've not fulfilled your obligations. And as far as I understand, Westpac has admitted to not individually assessing the ability to repay of over 10,000 loans.
You mentioned there the over 10,000 loans that were automatically approved. So what does this class action mean for those borrowers?
I'm not 100% sure what the outcome's going to be here. What happened is when ASIC took on Westpac about this breach of the 10,000, they ended up with a $35 million settlement. I'm not sure if you recall, but the federal court rejected that because, if I recall at the time, there was no agreement to what actions Westpac should take to comply with the law. So they've automatically approved these loans. ASIC says that's not in keeping with the law, but the federal court says, well, actually, why is that not? You need to decide why it's not before just paying the $35 million and continuing on your way. In terms of these individual loan applicants, I'm not sure if they're all part of this class action anyway, but possibly could be in the future. I'm not really sure what sort of remedies will come from this, even if the class action is successful. It's a very tricky situation. Do people have to repay money? Does Westpac have to write off some of the loans and let people keep the money? How does that reflect on the covenants that the titles of all the houses, for example, that these loans are secured against? It's going to be a very difficult thing to unravel what has been done. It may just be some kind of cash payout to these individuals who will end up essentially putting that cash back in the bank to repay the loan. So for the bank, it's on net the same as writing off some of the loans. So it's hard to know at this stage where it could go.
Westpac aren't the only bank that uses the household expenditure measure. So what does this mean for the other banks that do use it?
That's exactly right. My understanding is that what the banks are trying to do is, because they like not having to individually assess all the borrowers and look at their historical expenses in great detail, is they want to shift to a new measure, a new benchmark that they can use that's not this poverty level benchmark, that's something higher. So they want that administrative ease of handing out loans. But in the meantime, they're going to all have to drop the use of the household expenditure measure as this benchmark budget of a household, which, you know, when I do my budget with two kids, they're using something like $30,000 a year in costs for a family of four, and I can assure you my costs are multiple times that. So, yeah, other banks will be following this very closely and changing their practices based on this outcome as well, to avoid the risk of some of their borrowers doing the same thing, particularly if it's successful.
So let's pull back and look at the bigger picture. 5-10 years down the track, what kind of mark will this leave on the economy and on the banking sector?
I actually think in the next couple of years, it's going to be not that great from a macroeconomic perspective, because we've become so reliant on household lending, home sellers getting the money from selling their homes and cashing in, retirees, etc., people leveraging these home values, and people borrowing money to spend on their houses. And that's really stimulated the economy. And that has relied upon this relaxed lending standard. So as this tightens up, the next couple of years is likely to see continued home price falls, continued declines in spending of households and accessories and things like that. But in 5 years' time, I actually think what we'll see is banks shifting their lending away from just household mortgage lending towards business lending. They want to lend money. That's what banks do. So if it's tightened up on household lending, they might go, well, actually, we might invest in expertise in small business lending and loans for expanding business investment. And then that is actually very, very good for the economy. So I think if in the longer term, it will be very good, because what we really want is the banking system to work in favor of investment and expansion for business, to make better products, right? We don't really want banking to create and lend money for people to buy and sell the same houses off each other all the time.
Cameron Murray, Senior Economist at the Australia Institute, speaking there with Ben Robinson.
My name is François Carrière. I am at the UTS Business School, and you are listening to On the Money, summing up finance in one easy bite.
Woolworths has been praised for increasing the prices of their 2 and 3 litre cartons of milk in support of dairy farmers. The move is expected to boost confidence in the industry and is expected to give farmers back an extra $30 million a year. However, some feel more needs to be done to restructure the industry. Kevin Suarez has more.
In mid-February, Woolworths announced they will be increasing the price of their home brand milk in support of dairy farmers. It comes after allegations that selling $1 home brand milk in Coles, Woolworths and Aldi meant that farmers would not be paid sufficiently for their product. However, the Australian Consumer and Competition Commission found last year that this was not a major issue. Coles and Aldi have both chosen not to increase their prices, drawing criticism from Minister of Agriculture David Littleproud, who encouraged consumers who are interested in a sustainable dairy industry to shop for their milk elsewhere. But how do dairy farmers feel about $1 a litre prices? David Innall, the CEO of Australian Dairy Farmers, explains.
So for 8 years now, the store categories of milk, fresh milk, at $1 a litre has been a significant thorn in the industry's side. Not seeing any CPI movement, any increase at all in one particular line of fresh product has been of considerable concern. Not only do farmers feel devalued, seeing their product discounted like that, but also not seeing any retail increases come through in added revenue for farmers is of been considerable distress.
The move to increase prices has been praised by the Australian dairy farmers, but Mr. Innall says other changes still need to be made. Woolworths have since increased the price for their 2 and 3 litre cartons of milk to $2.20 and $3.30 respectively, with 10 cents per litre going back to the farmers. Mr. Innall predicts what effect this could have on the farmers.
Certainly on a number of levels, it will boost confidence, because this has been such a thorn in the industry side for such a long time, for 8 years now. So seeing move forward and past the dollar, there'll be a boost in confidence, definitely an increase in revenue coming back through to farmers. But also, importantly, it shines a light on the value and the importance of having a profitable and sustainable Australian dairy industry.
How does the supply chain for milk work? Milk is sold by farmers to processors for the treatment, bottling and labelling, then sold on to retailers such as Coles and Woolworths. According to Associate Professor Gary Mortimer of QUT's Business School, this supply chain can lead to the impression that supermarkets charging $1 a litre will mean that farmers will get less money, when this is not necessarily the case.
The challenge that I think supermarkets have faced in the past is that shoppers and consumers have really considered that the price of supermarket branded milk has had a negative impact on farmers. And that hasn't been the case. I mean, a quick look at the ACCC dairy inquiry found that there is a power imbalance between farmers and processors, but the retail price of milk has no correlation to farm gate price.
He says the supply chain for getting milk to our fridges is complex, especially as retailers and farmers have stronger relationships with the producers than with each other. Will this move actually get money back to the farmers despite the complex supply chain?
It will. So, you know, the situation is that farmers are looking for higher farm gate prices, processors are unwilling to pay a higher farm gate price to farmers, consumers are happy to pay more for their milk and are willing to do so, but the problem is how do I get that money back to those particular farmers that provided that particular milk? It's very, very difficult in a supply chain that's that long and that complex. So this way, the money will go directly back to farmers and therefore they will indirectly get a higher farm gate price for their milk.
Mr. Innall explains whether or not this price increase has been welcomed by the industry.
Absolutely. Now, recognising, of course, that this increase is for those dairy farmers who are supplying Woolworths, and there's around 450 farmers across Australia, and there's around 5,900 dairy farmers. So, yes, there are many farmers supplying other milk contracts that won't receive this money. However, what's important here is moving off the $1. It's an important next step in the conversation around retail value and increasing that value in the dairy cabinet.
However, while he also supports the move, Dr. Mortimer feels there are other ways to improve the industry.
I think the move towards providing more funding into the dairy farming industry is a step in the right direction, but I think it's a more complex issue around that. I mean, we need to look at consumer behaviour and consumer demand for the product. I often talk to my students in classes and say, when was the last time you had a nice, big, long, tall glass of milk? And nobody puts their hand up because they're busy drinking bottled water or Powerade drinks. So there's consumer demand for the product. That's an impact. There's efficiencies in working capital for farmers. You know, are they efficiently producing product or not? So quite a complex situation going through.
Rival retailers Coles and Aldi have drawn criticism for not following suit and increasing their respective milk prices. Mr. Innall outlined the ADF's position on Coles.
We're extremely disappointed that Coles did not see a way forward to move on dollar milk. It is important that they recognise the value of Australian dairy farmers. This is an important step. You cannot keep milk in this particular case at $1 forever. It needs to move. Farmers are asking to have this move forward. It's not the entire solution. It's not the silver bullet, but it is an important next step. It's a very public discussion.
Last year, the ACCC held a milk inquiry and published its final report into the industry in late April. It found that despite major supermarkets selling milk for $1 a litre, it does not significantly affect the money received by farmers, who are paid by producers and not the retailers. Dr. Mortimer explores the relationship between the farmers and producers.
Yeah, I think that's one area that the ACCC Dairy Inquiry looked at. There is a power imbalance between processors and farmers, and if your listeners were a farmer and they've milked cows and they've got 1,000 litres of milk to sell, you know, they go to a processor and the processor pays 35 cents a litre, take it or leave it. And the problem with farmers is that you can't leave it because what do you do with the milk? So you've got to sell it for what you can get it for. So there is a power imbalance. How do you change that without sort of, you know, having an impact on free market dynamics? I'm not sure. Potentially some regulation, some checks and balances in place. But ultimately, we have to remember we do work within a free market.
Mr. Reynolds says there are other ways for people to support the industry moving forward.
So purchasing dairy products is very important. Continuing to buy dairy, it's a true superfood. Ensure that's a part of your daily family consumption. But also, we just need to be asking the question of Coles and Aldi to please stop discounting milk at $1 a litre and ask those stores to move forward, have the conversation with the industry. It's time to break $1 milk.
David Inall, CEO of Australia Dairy Farmers, ending that report by Kevin Suarez. You're listening to On The Money around Australia on the Community Radio Network. I'm Roderick Chambers.
On The Money, hedge your bets and stay tuned.
Modern monetary theory has been gaining a lot of traction lately, particularly amongst left-leaning politicians. With the economy growing at an anemic pace through the developed world, people are increasingly looking for new solutions to the economic problem. With the so-called neoliberalism widely discredited and the preceding economic model also fairly unpopular, could modern monetary theory be the key to reviving our economic fortunes? Vincent Su asked Stephen Hale, Professor of Economics at the University of Adelaide, to explain the basis of modern monetary theory.
Well, there's a lot to modern monetary theory. More than 25 years of research by lots of economists and people from other disciplines too. But in a nutshell, the most important lesson to draw from it is that it's misleading to compare a federal government like the Australian Commonwealth government at the centre of a monetary system like ours to a household or a business or even a state government, because households and businesses and state governments are limited in what they can spend by what they can earn or what they can pay for from their savings or what they can borrow. And if they borrow now, they have to spend less or earn more in the future to pay it back, or they'll become bankrupt. None of that's true of the Australian Commonwealth government. And it's not true because we have our own currency in Australia, which isn't fixed to anything the government can run out of. And the government has no significant foreign currency debt, which means our government can't run out of money. It doesn't mean it can spend without limit, and it doesn't mean it doesn't need to tax us. But it does mean that its ability to pay for things is limited only by the productive capacity of the Australian economy. In other words, by our ability to produce things. So the limit on government spending in Australia is set by inflation, not by a lack of money.
So how was modern monetary theory developed? How did it come about?
Well, some of its roots go back over 100 years. It's a very long story. And the idea that governments ought to set their level of spending and their budget balance, or most of the time, governments like ours historically have run deficits, so the level of their deficit spending, in order to achieve non-inflationary full employment and without having an explicit target of trying to balance the budget or getting any other specific budgetary outcome, goes back at least to the 1940s and a Keynesian economist called Aberlerner and functional finance. But the modern-day version of it dates back to the early 1990s and was developed really by, I guess you could say, four economists, one of whom a fund manager, an entrepreneur, and Federal Reserve insider called Warren Mosler. The other three are academics, one of whom, Professor Bill Mitchell, is a very prominent Australian academic at the University of Newcastle who'll actually be on Q&A on the ABC in April at some point talking about these ideas. And the other two are somebody called Randall Ray, Professor Randall Ray from the US, who was a close colleague of famous economist called Hyman Minsky, that some of these ideas draw on Minsky's work. And the final one amongst the four is Professor Stephanie Kelton, who's in the news a lot at the moment because she's chief economic advisor of Bernie Sanders, who's just announced that he's standing for the presidency again in the US this time around. They're the people that came up with a modern version of MMT. It is based on a detailed understanding of how monetary systems in countries like the US or Australia or the UK or Japan, or any other countries you might like to mention that share the characteristics which I listed earlier, having their own currency, not fixing their currency to anything, and the government not having any significant foreign currency debt, how those monetary systems work, and also how the balance sheets, how the financial well-being of the private sector and the government sector interrelate to each other. Because when governments run deficits, that means they're spending more than they're taking in taxation. And that means the rest of us run surpluses under those circumstances. When the government runs a deficit, they give us more money or they spend more money into the economy than they take out. Because one person or one institution's spending is somebody else's income, if the private sector as a whole wants to net save, wants to spend less than its income, then somebody else has to spend more than their income to make that possible. And historically, what's normally been the case in most countries is for governments to do that deficit spending. When governments run surpluses, bearing in mind that every dollar the government spends is a new dollar, and that taxes we pay to the government destroy dollars, when the government runs a fiscal surplus, which is what the current government is promising to do next year and what the ALP is also saying that it's going to do, that weakens private sector balance sheets. They're actually taking more dollars out of circulation than they're putting into circulation. Either the economy has to be supported by the private sector taking on more debt, and in Australia in recent times that's meant household debt, or that pushes the economy towards a recession.
So what problem is modern monetary theory trying to solve? What's with the conventional thinking of monetary theory that's trying to be solved here?
Well, the problem that we're trying to solve is the inappropriate use of the metaphor of the government as a household in Australia, which is the way that both the government and the main opposition party in recent years have discussed the government budget, what we call fiscal policy. It's not the way it always has been discussed historically, but over the last 30 years, and it seems to me more and more in recent years, politicians on both sides of government have talked about the government maxing out on its credit card or spending like a drunken sailor, and drawn more and more inappropriate parallels between the government's finances and households' finances. Households cannot deficit spend year after year after year. They can't build up more and more and more debt. Eventually, they get into trouble, and they end up going bankrupt under those circumstances. That view of the world, or that parallel, is completely inappropriate when we think about the federal government. For the federal government, most of the time in the past and most of the time in the future, there has been and there will be a fiscal deficit. This is a good thing as long as it's not too big. If deficit spending's too high, then there'll be too much spending in the economy as a whole and there'll be inflation. But if the level of deficit spending by the government is right, then we'll be able to achieve non-inflationary full employment and we'll be able to do it without driving more and more household debt and asset bubbles like the property bubble, which we're on the brink of a possible collapse of at the moment. What we'd like to do is we'd like to move back to a situation of full employment in Australia. There was full employment in Australia between 1950 and the mid-1970s. The unemployment rate was between 1% and 2% for most of that time, and there was no underemployment or no significant underemployment. We now have an official unemployment rate of 5%, which the government crows about, but it's actually quite difficult to qualify to be unemployed in Australia now. When we add the underemployed into the statistic in Australia, we've got something like 13.5% of our labour force, which either doesn't have a job or doesn't have as much work as people want. We'd like to eliminate that, and we'd like to eliminate that by having a federal job guarantee in Australia.
Stephen Hale, Professor of Economics at the University of Adelaide, speaking there with Vincent Su. Don't forget to tune in next week for part two of this series. You're listening to On the Money around Australia on the Community Radio Network. I'm Roderick Chambers. And that's all we have time for on the Money this week. Tune in again next week to find out everything you need to know about finance, business and the economy. Thanks to our producers, Vincent Su, Ben Robinson and Kevin Suarez. On the Money is produced in the studios of Radio 2SER for the Community Radio Network. You can find all of our shows and stories at 2ser.com/onthemoney. Check us out on Instagram too. Follow us on Twitter, look for @onthemoney2ser and find us on Facebook. I'm Roderick Chambers. We'll be back again next week to give you the inside running on all things financial. Thanks for your company.